It's just Marina or Rav Shlita. I thought we'll do some shiurim dealing with births, dealing with bar mitzvahs, dealing with weddings. Not with deaths, but maybe wills. So today we're going to talk about childbirth. I'm going to just take a little pick at a number of topics and we'll see how we get on. Everybody knows that when it comes to childbirth, a woman is treated as though she is a chole sheyesh bosakono. A woman who is considered as having her life in danger, even though childbirth is a regular thing and it shouldn't be with any complications. For purposes of Hilchot Shabbos and Yom Tov and so on, she is treated as an emergency. Indeed, when my wife the first time started labour, it was on a weekday, but I dashed her to the hospital at 5:30 in the morning, thinking as though she was about to drop any minute, driving like a maniac, only to discover that she didn't give birth for another 16 and a half hours later. But that's the way it goes. Let's say a woman just feels anguished at something. It's not threatening to her life. But let's say, for example, the woman has given birth, and she's blind, and she wants the Shabbos candles to be lit, because they were not lit before Shabbos came in. Can you light the Shabbos candles for her? She can't even see them. But she asks for the Shabbos candles to be lit. The halacha is yes, one does light the Shabbos candles in accordance with her request. Why? Because it gives her a peace of mind to know that they are lit. So there is something psychological there. And we find that the rabbis were very keen to make sure that where there is psychological anguish, that can affect a woman's health, and therefore we should consider her request positively. Similarly, in the Gemara in Yuma, Daf Pei Beis on the Aleph, it talks there about a pregnant woman on Yom Kippur who can smell some delicious food, and she becomes agitated by it, and she expresses a desire to eat as a result of that. So you get a psychological anguish, and it was ruled that she may eat on Yom Kippur when she gets this sudden desire, because her health might be at risk as a result if she does not eat. Any time during pregnancy. If she becomes severely agitated by the smell of food, now I'm not giving out any heteri for your pregnant wives to eat on Yom Kippur, these things can become a shayla to Rav, but there is such a concept. La locha velo lemasa. The woman is an emergency. When it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, ideally, preferably, one should do things with a shinoi, in a different way. If one has to phone for an ambulance, knock the phone off with your elbow. If you are going to have a choice as to how to take the woman to the hospital, one should try and do it in such a way that one minimizes. So if you can get a non-Jewish person to drive you there, it's much better, provided that it will be just as quickly and just as efficiently. But there's no reason why you shouldn't drive it yourself. The problem nowadays is the car parking. They'll count the car and you won't get it back afterwards. So if you can get a lift, get a guy to do it, all the better. But if you do drive, you can't drive back afterwards because there's no emergency anymore. The emergency is so long as to bring her to the hospital. When is it an emergency? To bring her there. To bring her back? For you to drive back? There's no emergency. If it's a Hatzalah ambulance, a Hatzalah ambulance takes an emergency case to the hospital, they are told that they may drive back because they are on standby for future possible emergencies. And even if you're doubtful whether there will be an emergency, if there might be one, then we treat it as an emergency case. So that solar ambulance will drive back. Now, when a woman gives birth, she's still treated as an emergency for 3 days afterwards. So anything which you feel should be done for her may be done without any asking of questions. And a further 4 days afterwards, after those 3 days, if she feels she desires it or if she requests it. For example, she might feel faint or whatever it is, then one will do things on Shabbos or Yom Tov as though she is a pikuach nefesh. After that week is up, from 8 to 30 days after the birth, she is not treated as danger to life unless
there are complications. She's called a chole she'ein bo sakono.
What does that mean? No melacha is actually done for her, but we do compromise on the dinim d'rabbanon, such as muktzah, asking a goy to do any form of work, and so on. If there is before giving birth a threat of a possible miscarriage, we treat her as a danger to life, and that anything should be done, even if it's no danger to her life, but danger to the baby's life. So the baby is born, Baruch Hashem, all is okay, and 8 days pass, and it's a boy, so we come to the subject of Bris Milah. As we commonly know, babies which are yellow, suffering from jaundice, do not get a bris. Seems that the doctors are more lenient on the yellowness than the Moralim are. But any slight risk to the baby's health, we will not do a bris on the eighth day. The shaila of yellowness isn't such a common one because it's a widespread issue. But something which is not maybe so commonly known is, what if the baby is underweight? What if the baby is very small? I had the experience of my third child being underweight. If the baby seems completely healthy, there's no yellow, well, one can ask the question, well, why is the baby small? Maybe it's because it's premature. Maybe it's because of the position of the baby inside the womb, that it wasn't growing properly. It might have had a cord around its neck, or it wasn't in the womb properly, or whatever it is. Some say that when babies grow up in an environment where there was a lot of smoking going on, or if the mother smokes, that can cause a small baby. And there are articles written on the subject where there isn't really anything clear-cut, though, amongst the poskim about what do you do if the baby is very small. The Moralim generally, though, will refuse to do a bris if the baby is less than 6 pounds in weight. Because once it's 6 pounds, they will say, well, now it's functioning according to its growth and will be able to take an operation. Before that, they're very reluctant to do a bris. So my son's bris was delayed by 5 weeks simply because of his weight and for no other reason whatsoever. So we had this fun in just drawing a graph according to its weight, working out when it will reach the 6 pounds, and bang on, that was time for the bris. And then you don't have to wait 8 days from that time, one just does it straight away. Unfortunately, in this day and age, there is a scare going on relating to HIV infection. And therefore the shaila comes up about metzitsa. After the cutting has taken place, there is a metzitsa when the moel will suck blood from the baby. And there is also the perea. I didn't think that I was causing such a scare. So the moral does his bit, the VIP cuts the tape, and then there comes the metzitsa. The metzitsa is to suck, and that's part of the ikkar mitzvah. And so is the prion, to push back with one's thumbnail skin. Those are essential parts of the bris. There was a big controversy 100, 150 years ago about some moralim who started to use a tube for the purpose of metzitsa. They felt it was more hygienic, whatever it is. And in fact, the Mishnah Berurah does allude to the controversy in Hilchos Shabbos, because there in Siman Shin Lamed Aleph, the question arises as to whether it's better to use a tube for purposes of Hilchos Shabbos. Because when you are sucking, it's din of mefarik, it's drawing out, just like, well, milking a cow, if I may use the analogy. There is the idea of dash. So one of the malachas of Shabbos would be drawing out blood, or wounding, you could say, is drawing out blood. On the other hand, if the Torah says you do a bris on the eighth day, you do a bris on the eighth day. It doesn't matter if it's a malacha. It's one of the things which you break Shabbos for. The Mishnah Berurah actually remarks the Shavuos Binyan Tzion, and he says it in the Bil Halacha, that he says metzitzo is dafka bepeh and not by any other means. But then he brings a tshuva called Yad Eliezer, who says, well, maybe with some form of sponge, he talks about, it might be okay. So in a way, the Halacha sits on the fence on this. The Steich Emed writes a very long treatise on the subject of metzitsa. And he actually reproduces a poster which was displayed in the streets of Jerusalem about 110 years ago, saying on no account may anybody do mitzitza other than by the traditional method of the mouth. That is our tradition. Minag Yisrael Torah, it may not be done in any other way. Nowadays, there is a risk of HIV infection, and even if a family, even if parents have not acted in any way immorally, they might have some blood transfusion or whatever it is, have been infected. And so the moel does have the risk, as it were, slight that it might be, of contracting HIV infection. Well, I spoke to my brother-in-law, who is a moel, and asked him what is the current stand, and he was told that where a moel feels uncomfortable, for whatever reason, he does do it by a tube nowadays. Many still do it, especially in the Haimish Oilom, as it's called, by means of Matzitza Bepeh. And it is left up to the moel at the end of the day as to how he wishes to do it. Yes, there are possibly both ways, really. But in the light of the current situation, moelim are resorting, even the Haimish moelim, as if I may call them that way, are resorting to tubes, especially when they're flown out into the wilds. I mean, moelim do travel to the most ridiculously strange places to do a bris, whether it's in the heart of Africa or wherever. And moelim, in the last 10 years, have increasingly been resorting to the tube method in order that there is no contact with the blood directly. Yes. So what is very interesting about bris milah is that even families who are so far from Yiddishkeit and they don't keep anything else, they do keep bris milah, which is itself a wonderful thing. The Gemara in Shabbos in the 19th Perek talks about those mitzvahs which the Jews originally gave up their lives for are the mitzvahs which all the Jews keep now. And those mitzvahs which the Jews did not give up their lives for, unfortunately the Jews don't keep so much now. And it is a remarkable thing that Jews always were prepared to give up their lives for bris milah. And nowadays, even the Jews who are so far away from Yiddishkeit, who don't know about the beauty of Yiddishkeit and are not committed, they nevertheless will try to ensure that their children have a bris milah. And these people being so far away, in spiritual terms, nevertheless resort to getting a moel and so on. And in those cases, the moel will usually use a tube, having some worry about his own safety. Another interesting question which comes up in contemporary issues is the use of an anaesthetic. Why is it that we do not use an anaesthetic? Well, for the baby, that the baby shouldn't suffer any pain. The question is dealt with by Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And I did speak to my brother-in-law who is a moel about it. His opinion as a doctor is that the pain which the baby suffers is no greater than the pain the baby would suffer if it's having, say, an immunization. If the baby is just 8 years old... If the baby is just 8 days old... Sorry, I'm suffering from jet lag. I've been abroad this week. If the baby is just 8 days old, the view is in the medical profession that the baby does not really suffer any noticeable pain. There are occasions where some babies might be crying for a few hours afterwards, but in general, you'll find that the crying stops very soon afterwards. The view of the Igros Moshe, which he writes about in his last section on Yerodeah, in Simon Mem, is that we do not resort to an anaesthetic if we can avoid it. He relies on the idea of tradition. He says we do not know how the anaesthetic might affect the baby's health, and therefore unless, he says, there are compelling reasons, for example if you know that the baby will be very sensitive, or if you know the baby will be crying for many hours, then he seems to be sanctioning it. What my brother-in-law told me is that they do use a local anaesthetic if it's a baby who is a bit older, like a 1-year-old or a 2-year-old baby, then it is recognized that there will be pain, and they do use a local anaesthetic. They also use a local anaesthetic for adults. However, if it's 11 or 12 year old, then his view is to use a general anaesthetic, because a local anaesthetic might be not right for that age. So they do, within some degree, accommodate it. But if possible, it is avoided. Well, the view of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Moshe Feinstein is She'ein osin tadema l'tinek, putting it to sleep. Mishum shalotem kalal samei. Cream. Yeah, he doesn't write about cream. The view which is projected is that there might be some sort of side effect, and we don't know what that might be. And we've always had a tradition for thousands of years that we've never had to use anything, and therefore, is it really necessary? But there's no compelling reason why one shouldn't use a cream or something like that. It wouldn't invalidate the risk.
Maybe there's some sort of spiritual benefit in subconsciously undergoing this.
Well, we do recognise in halacha that the child does suffer to some extent. We don't say the bracha shechionu and a priest. We say tzar dininukar. The pain for the child, so we don't overly celebrate. But it's a mitzvah, it has to be done, and everybody recovers very well from it. I haven't found anything written about creams, but from the way Rav Moshe writes, there's nothing to prevent it.
I would assume that he writes about injections.
Yes. I can read to you his exact words. I will look at him. For children, osin kafiya yose adif lenabriosom, we do what's best for the health. Rab kashiyesh tzurich lakotin kazeh. But if there is a need for the child, the tzrichim lasos, eizenitzurach, we do, if it's felt that we do need to do something, sheyesh lechush yivke bekel godol, there is the worry he'll be crying a lot, and shiachin bezeh, it will give him a great pain. Tzurich eshechul isale manyudeizeh b'malach nevasiyas hanitzurach, then it's acknowledged that one gives some form of samei tardemo, sounds like some sleeping pill or something. Below there ain't no sin samei tardemo, but without any such worry, we don't give anything. So that seems to be the general view. So we move ahead from the bris, and we come to the naming of the child. We have discussed naming of children in the past, to some extent, although I didn't deal with the whole subject. An interesting idea which comes up is what is a very common practice nowadays when we name the child, is to give the child more than one name, to give it two names. And the Noda Behuda asks a question about this. He says, as far as I can remember, Eini zocha b'shumachem b'shas. I can't recall anywhere in the whole of Shas Shum Tana or Amara, any Tana or Amara, or for that matter, going back earlier in the Chumash, in Tanakh, Shaydis Kabashnei Shemos, where a person is given two names. Alright, you've got Abba Shaul, you've got Abba Yossi, but Abba is not really a name, it's like a, more like a title. That's not really Shnei Shemos, he says. And therefore, I question, why is it that we give two names? Because a name has a special significance for a child. A child that reflects in his personality what name is given to him. So therefore, he questions, why is it that we give children two names? And the same question arose in the Shalos Tshuvos of the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer writes in Nevin Oezer, Chelek Bei Simen Yud Ches, he says, in former times, lo hayinagin lekros b'shnei shemos b'vas achas. And even though Yaakov had the name Yisrael, he was never called both at the same time. And we don't find this in Shas or in Poskim, that you have two names. However, nevertheless, although we quote the Chasam Sofer, it is noted in the Sefer Mishnah Halachos that the Ksav Sofer himself had three names, Avram, Shmuel, Binyamin. And the Gaon of Munkach was quoted as various names being given. The Chidah, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulay was his name. The Gaon Maran Harav Chidah, as the Sfaradim call him. He had three, may I call them Christian names. The Ksav Sofer we've quoted, there was the Netziv, his name was Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. So the practice has become prevalent to give more than one name to a child. And maybe the custom arose because the father wanted to give the child a name and the mother wanted to give a child a name, and in order there's not too much argument between the two, so they both had a go. Tradition seems to be that the father gives the first name and the mother gives the second child's name, and so on, they take turns. Although, strangely, if you look in the Chumash, with Leah it says, Vatikro Shemo, and all the time it was the mother giving the name. So, at least the women are here today, otherwise they'll all be claiming their rights to give the names themselves. It's an interesting idea. Yeah, you do get names which join together, merge as a result of that.
Is there a shy about naming somebody after two people?
Well, that's also why people give two names. They name after one grandfather or a great-grandfather from the other side. Yes, in fact it's written that if one is going to name a child after somebody who dies prematurely, then one should give an additional name of somebody who did not die prematurely.
Is it also possible to try and name a child after some sort of relative ancestor, preferably, like grandfather or great-grandfather, something like that? That if you're afraid that
Yes, it's regarded as a kibbud av or kibbud aim, or a respect for one's own ancestry, to give a name and the child should emulate their ways. There is also a tradition for a child to be named after a teacher, a rebel, somebody like that. But there's no hard and fast rules. And that if one names a child a name which is not in the family, it's not regarded as a terrible thing. Sometimes a name is a seasonal name, like a child born on Simchas Torah might be called Simcha or something like that. So, there are various minhagim, and there are no hard and fast rules. That's right, and there might not be subsequent children to give such names to, and therefore you pile them on. And I've got a friend whose first names are Yitzhak, David, Gershon. I think he's got four names. Parents like to pile them on, but as long as the banks don't mind when they print out your checks to fill up all these names on the form. Yes, there is quite a section in a various form written about not naming after somebody who died very young, as I said. Okay, there is also a question of whether you name a female after a male or a male after a female. We might have discussed this in the past, I can't remember. It is correct to name a male after a female. It is okay, but it's not traditional to name a female after a male. Why is that? Well, it's to do with the fact that the male keeps more mitzvahs than the female. So if you give the male a female's name, and then the male adds to that with his masculinity, as it were, and one isn't making a step down. But the other way around, the tradition is not to name the female after a male, where we are feminizing masculine names or masculinizing feminine names. So that's the idea of naming in a nutshell. In the Parsha of Vayetze, Leah is giving birth to a number of children while Rachel is looking on. Leah has the Ruach HaKodesh to see that there will be 12 children born. And then she discovers she has a fourth child. So she realizes she's getting more than what might be her fair share, because there are four mothers, so to speak. So she thought they would get three each.
That's the point. The Archer hadn't married the other.
That's right. Yes. That's right. But she had the Ruach HaKodesh that there will be Leah, Rachel, and Bilhah, and Zilpah. And she gets a fourth child. So she names that fourth child Yehuda. Yehuda, she says, Hapam Ode Es Hashem. I really thank Hashem. And what is so remarkable about this Hapam Ode Es Hashem? Because some people, they get another child, and they get another child, and they get another child, and somehow they're not as appreciated as the first ones were. Every single child is a gift. And so Leah was recognizing that even though she was getting a bonus, as it were, which she wasn't expecting, but it was another one, another, Hapam Odes Hashem, she was still nevertheless showing her Hakaros HaTov by saying Odes Hashem, and she called that child Yehuda. Every single child is a gift from Hashem. Every single child, we should say Odes Hashem. Yehuda, the name Yehuda, is in fact the name which Jews are called after. The Jews are called Jews because of Yehuda. Why? Because we should always have Hakaros HaTov. We should always be saying, oh, there's Hashem. I thank Hashem for everything He's doing for us. And nothing should be taken for granted. There are other reasons why the Jews are called after Yehuda. Yehuda Atzadosa de Tomar. He admitted his guilt when it came to the story of Tomar. He told the Emes. He told the truth. Jews stand up for Emes. The most important thing to remember is that we have Hakaros HaTov for every single child we have. Every child is a gift. It's not that we will have the right to choose whether we have a child or not, to choose the sex of the child as it is nowadays. We should always recognize that the child is a gift from Hashem, and for that we say, Hapam Odes Hashem. Thank you very much.